Good afternoon, everyone, or if you are with Peter Lovesey in the UK, good evening. So nice to see you, Peter. I know it's probably, 9 o'clock there in England?
Yes, nearly bedtime.
Oh, please, come on, we're younger than that. Anyway, it is such a pleasure to have a conversation today with a very dear, very long-term friend, Peter Lovesey. And Peter, I was thinking, because I've been asked to write a piece about Agatha Christie, I was thinking about when we first met, and you may remember this better than I, or I may be mistaken, but I think when we first met, Rob and I appeared at the Agatha Christie Centenary in Torquay at a banquet. And we were new to the book world and new to the Crime Writers Association. And you were seated. There were four of you who welcomed us. And it was you and your lovely wife, Jax, Sheila and Harry Keating, Robert Barnard and his wife, and Robert Richardson and his wife. Unless I am misremembering it. Do you recall this at all?
No, I do. I do remember. I remember that the lunch went on and for a very long time. And our party, I forget who it was, said toward the end of the evening, "That's the last Agatha Christie centenary lunch I shall be attending," which I rather enjoyed.
It was actually a wonderful weekend in Turkey, highlighted for me by dancing with David Suchet, which I have to say I never expected to do, because David Suchet and Joan Hickson, who, if you recall, were the iconic Poirot and Miss Marple, came down on a special train and debarked on the little platform there in Torquay. I've always remembered that. But anyway, you were incredibly kind. You four distinguished British crime writers to this total unknown. And it was such a warm welcome. And I've always remembered it. So thank you for being so nice to me.
It was, I'm sure it was no hardship at all to be nice to you, Barbara.
Well,
Rob was there too, was he?
He was. Rob was there. Other thing I remember, which really annoyed me, is that we didn't realize that the banquet was going to be formal. So Rob was easily able to rent formal evening wear in Torquay. But it's not possible for women to just go out and rent a tux. And I had, the only thing I had with me that even faintly resembled a dinner dress was a Southwestern dress from Santa Fe that I actually used to wear to go grocery shopping. And it was all I had. So here was Rob, like a penguin. And all of you, so elegant. Here was I in this Southwestern.
I'm sure it was entirely suitable.
Well, it was exotic. And anyway, but it's one of those moments that separates men from women on occasions.
I have no memory of what I was wearing, I can tell you.
You were also wearing a penguin suit because it was a black tie affair. So I've always thought that men have it so much easier than women when it comes to things like that. But anyway, and the next thing I remember, Peter, is let's talk about your wonderful book, Diamond and the Eye, which is the 20th Superintendent Peter Diamond of the Bath Constabulary. But let's talk about the first one, The Last Detective, because you were then working with my very dear and sadly departed too early friend, Sarah Ann Freed. She was your editor then.
Yes, and that's going back 30 years when that was published, and Sarah, Sarah was my editor and for several books, and she was a lovely person and much loved by everybody in the crime writing world, her tragically early death was awful it still is awful to contemplate. I really admired her and respected her and was so grateful for the input into my books. She made good suggestions, yes.
She was a very insightful and enthusiastic reader. And I had a conversation with Robert Dagoni earlier this week in which he's written a book. And one of the themes of the book, Peter, is that growing old is a privilege, not a right. Which you and I can certainly speak to, right, as octogenarians. But I thought about that with Sarah Ann, you know, that for her, growing old wasn't
a
privilege.
No.
Anyway, you had burst upon the crime scene over 50 years ago, because I remember your own 50th anniversary. Was it last year or the year before?
Last year. 1970 was my first crime novel. Wobble to Death, which was the first of a series featuring Sergeant Cribb, a Victorian detective, which got onto television and did rather well for me and enabled me in the end to give up the day job, which was teaching, and become a full-time writer, which I've been doing since 1976. It has its hairy moments, but basically it's a wonderful life, and I've got to be enormously grateful that I've been able to keep going with the support of my good wife, Jax.
Well, there are 8 Sergeant Cribbs. Wobble to Death. You might explain what Wobble is for anyone who doesn't know.
Yes, it was a long distance running contest, which would go on an ultra long distance. And we're not talking marathons here. We're talking ultra long distance, 6 days of running. They would be allowed to stop and take rests and sleep on the way, but they did it all indoors at the Agricultural Hall, Islington in London. And of course, by the time they'd been going a few hours, they would be in a pretty bad state. And instead of running, they would tend to walk. So they were originally called Go As You Please contests. But the press, when they saw the state of the runners walking, they decided to call them wobbles. So they wobbled their way around the track. And for me, it was a classic whodunit formula, the 6 days enabled me to think of it almost as an Agatha Christie weekend murder, where the detective could come in and everybody was confined to the hall where all this was going on. And there were people with all sorts of motives, because there were betting and there were drugs taken and there were rivalries and there were sort of ladies who the men were interested in and who were determined that their one should be the favorite and so on. And a big prize at the end. But as well as deciding sort of who did the murder, I had to decide who won the race. And that gave it a sort of double incentive. You wanted to read to the end, not only to find out who did it, but who won it. And that was the way it worked out.
Well, it was enormously successful. I was thinking Agatha Christie died in 1976, so she was still with us when you wrote it. And it is a classic sort of a variation on a country house design, isn't it? A particular place with a boundary and only therefore so many possible suspects for the murder of the victim.
Yes, very much a traditional mystery, really, with a different setting.
And interestingly, even though it was that long ago, the power of television to affect book sales and public interest in a particular series or characters was possible even then. I mean, we see it in a really accelerated form right now, especially with long form television storytelling. But I've always thought that, how neat it was that TV made Sergeant Cribb, really made him famous, and you too.
Yes, it did. And fortunately, PBS TV took it up. And so I was able to travel to America to do some publicity here, in your country, I should say. And that was a big bonus for me. And I first really began to get to know people on the other side of the ocean.
Where you have been enormously popular and won many awards. Peter is winner of the Diamond Dagger Award, which is really the Crime Writers Association's highest honor. But you've also won an Edgar and been all kinds of other things. So you've had a really distinguished career, haven't you, as well as fun?
Yes, well, it's lovely. I mean, the awards are lovely when they come. But you just hope really that the books are well received as they are published.
Well, Peter's a wonderful stylist, but he has a truly ingenious mind. for crime. I sometimes think he could have been a born criminal. So clever is he. So you wrote 8 Sergeant Crib, and you've written several standalones. I really loved your triple, your trilogy about Bertie, the Prince of Wales.
Yes, another Victorian series, but because he was her son, and waiting for his chance to be king, and getting up to all sorts of mischief in his spare time. So I made him a pretty incompetent detective who somehow got to the truth of the matters, very often with the help of his wife Alexandra, who was much cleverer than he was, but enjoying all sorts of the kinds of things that Edward the Seventh did enjoy in his youth.
Well, it's always fun to read about the Gilded Age, because we know it all came crashing down shortly after Edward died. He died in 1911, I think it was. And so we only had 3 years before World War I shattered that whole world. But I bring it up because while the Peter Diamond books are contemporary crime, oftentimes they are rooted in the past, or they have, it takes history and historical research to make them work out. What inspired you to write The Last Detective, Peter?
Well, that was a little bit of history too. I think I was interested in Jane Austen and her connections with Bath. I live near Bath, and it's a great city with wonderful history. All sorts of well-known characters have lived there, and a few sordid things have gone on there as well. But basically, it's got a high reputation as a fashionable place. Was made fashionable by a character called Beau Nash in the 18th century, it seemed to me that it was people like Colin Dexter was writing books about Oxford, and others were writing books set in particular cities in Britain, and I thought, well, why not Bath? So I thought it's ideal for a setting for a story. So that came along, and then I began to dig, and I thought, well, something to do with Jane Austen, possibly, because, as you say, I rather always like, if possibly, if I can, to bring in some historical tidbits. And then I did some research and found out that Jane Austen's Aunt Jane was arrested for shoplifting in Bath. Actually, you know, more than just being arrested, she was taken off and spent quite a bit of time in prison waiting for her trial to come up, when the family managed to organize all kinds of people to come and speak up on her behalf for her character, and she got away. But I rather think that she was guilty and was actually stealing the lace from the shop that she'd come into, and she walked away with this card of lace under her clothes. But that gave me sort of a little incident to work around, and I did, and I soon had a professor who was interested in Jane Austen and various other characters, and it began to work its way into a novel, which was so easy for me because, I live near there, and I was able to come in and wander the streets and imagine things going on. And that's been the process pretty well through all the series, that I find some little thing that triggers an idea, and the idea grows, and it becomes a novel that for me is amusing and interesting. And of course, I had to find a detective who would fit in and work things out. And that's Peter Diamond, who, at the beginning, he was a hardened policeman. He was called The Last Detective because I thought it would be a one-off book. And that he was one of the old school of detectives. Although it was set in the contemporary times, it was the 1990s when it appeared, he harked back temperamentally to the old detectives of the 1940s, who used to go around in these sort of trench coats and hats and were featured in black and white films and went around in cars called Black Marias and so on. But he was, in a way, it presented me with a rather odd situation, because he was meant to be middle-aged and old, and I pictured him at the beginning as portly, and I don't think I said precisely how old he was, but I'm still writing about him 30 years later. And by now he would be pensioned off. I think he would be older than you or me.
Oh, God forbid. But well, no, I mean, I love the way that, you know, you're right. I mean, he hasn't really aged in real time, but nonetheless, you have changed his life. You know, he was married and then widowed, and then he's had other relationships. He's kind of famously grumpy. He has to deal with both superiors and inferiors in the police. And in fact, you've relocated, because apparently you've relocated his headquarters out of Bath, which was a blow for him. And actually, Bath is a tough city to navigate. It's a difficult city to drive in. I've spent time there and really love it, but the geography of it makes it kind of a traffic disaster.
Yeah, it's best to walk, really is.
Truly. But it's also a city, I mean, it goes way back to Roman times, because, you know, the Baths, is called Bath because in part there actually are hot springs there, which was a welcome respite in Roman Britain from temperature. People came to get clean, they came to get warm, they came to get healthy, which is really what happened in the 18th century as well. It was kind of like, you know,
it was revived in a big way. And it's, I had this problem that that's what it's most famous for, but I couldn't really have scenes featuring the Roman baths. Or the other big thing it's famous for is the beautiful Royal Crescent high on the slopes, a wonderful Palladian crescent, that is renowned and is featured on all the postcards and all the pictures of Bath. But those two things, you know, do come into the books, but I couldn't really bring them into every book, so I've had to look for other locations in and around Bath, and I think I've almost used them all up now.
Well, there's the River Avon, there's the wonderful cathedral, it's a gorgeous building. You know, I think of the Royal Crescent, I mean, you're right, it's quintessential Bath in a way, but you know, the thing I still remember best about the Royal Crescent, it has a dog spit in the kitchen. That's first time that I had actually encountered a dog spit. And for those of you wondering what that is, in order to roast meats over the open fire, the spit needed to be churned. And usually that was done by a person, but in this, I think it's at the end of the Royal Crescent, which is, what is it, National Trust or English Heritage? I can't remember which.
Probably the latter.
One or the other. But anyway, when you go in, they're very proud to show you that, in fact, this kitchen has a dog spit, meaning that a dog was harnessed to the spit and that it would go around and around while the meat cooked. So. Yeah, I love stuff like that that sticks in your head. But what Peter has done over the course of 20 books is that he has brought in various wonderful aspects of Bath history, which is, and there's tons of it. So in the vault, we were actually looking at Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, and what is it? Was she buried there? I'm trying to remember. It's called the vault for a reason.
No, she was really on the run with Shelley. I think they were sort of illicitly together, and they had come back from the continent, and she had this experience with Dr. Polidori and the others in the big storm by the lake at Italy, when they were all confined to one place and they had to think up a story, and she thought up Frankenstein, which was far better and far more memorable than the stories anybody else thought up. But she had to write it. And when she came back to England, she holed up in Bath over a shop, which was within a stone's throw of Bath Abbey. It doesn't exist anymore. But I know exactly where it was, and I did a bit of investigation and worked out a plot in which there might be a vault still in existence. There are a lot of vaults, underground places in Bath, and this could easily be one of them. So it was underneath the Roman Baths extension. And I had an American professor who knew a lot about Jane Austen coming over about Mary Shelley rather, coming over to investigate where Frankenstein had been written. I'd found that it's a little known fact that she wrote most of Frankenstein in Bath, but now they've cottoned on to it after a long time. Somebody read my book and they started doing Bath walks, Mary Shelley walks in Bath for the tourists. And now they have
you've been a boon to tourism in Bath. I love
and
that.
Now they have a Frankenstein house in Bath, which has got, is not the place that I found. It's completely different, and but it has an exhibition going on, and they'd probably be delighted if I'm publicising it now. But I haven't been to see it, so I can't say any more about it.
So I was mistaken. It's Bath Abbey, not Bath Cathedral. And it's really a gorgeous building. And of course, there's the pump room. And that figures in. But let me go back further, because one of my very favorites in this wonderful series about Peter Diamond is called Skeleton Hill. And when you say Civil War reenactment to American readers, that means obviously one thing. But when you say Civil War reenactors to British readers, it means something entirely different.
Ah, well, I don't know. I'm not quite sure what the distinction is, but to Brits, it really, they dress up and they try to figure out how the battle was fought, and lots of enthusiasts come and they'll carry out a mock battle, and plenty of people will come and look and see what's going on, and there's great enthusiasm about it. And so this battle of the Civil War battle, which happened back after the in the time of the Stuarts in the 17th century, I think, it was a great event, Battle of Lansdowne, and I can't now, you caught me asking me about this book, because I can't remember the full details, but it happened on Lansdowne Hill, which is a great hill outside to the west of Bath.
Absolutely, and you can imagine that if you have people firing weapons, whether pretend or not, it's an excellent opportunity to fire a real bullet and kill somebody.
Oh, yes.
What I meant by the difference is that Americans flash on our own Civil War, which was, 1860 to 65, whereas if you say Civil War in England, obviously you flash back to the 17th century and in the 1640s when the Roundhead, the Cromwell and his Puritan gang went up against the Royalists. So it's just a different Civil War, but wonderful cover for a murder and an investigation. There's a wonderful book about Japan and a Japanese gentleman in music called The Tooth Tattoo. And then we mentioned Beau Nash, who was the master of ceremonies, so to speak, in the 18th century in the pump room. Mm-hmm. So we have Beau Death, which is kind of touches upon that. And then the next book, the 19th book, circles all the way back to Wobble to Death, because Peter, you decided that you would pay homage, so to speak, to your first book by giving Superintendent Diamond an opportunity with another running contest.
Yes, he wasn't taking part, but he was investigating, and it was a half marathon. There is a famous half marathon run in Bath, but mine was a little different. I had to make it a little different for obvious reasons. If you're having sinister goings on in a half marathon, it's got to be a fictional one. So mine was a fictional one over a very different course, I went back almost to the sort of golden age sort of book with a little map in the front showing the route. Diamond, of course, doesn't really have a lot of sympathy for the runners and what's going on, but gets drawn into the case, and it was quite successful. I think it was one of my most popular books.
Very successful. And I brought all these up because one of the joys of this series is that every book is so different, prompted by, a different idea. I mean, Diamond, as I've mentioned earlier, evolves somewhat, at least in his personal life, although hanging on to sort of an ageless persona, which I love. But every book gives you a chance to experience new and different things and show off Peter's astonishing plot skills. So now we finally arrive at Diamond in the Eye. And this one, you decided to bring in a guy who's in love with the American private eye novel and the vernacular of guys like Hammett and Chandler. So what fun. Why did you decide to sort of braid these two different streams together?
I was thinking about Diamond and the problem that all mystery writers who use policemen as their main characters have, in that you want your detective to be there when all the action happens, and to be involved in the questioning and the knocking on doors and the chases and all that sort of thing. But it's unrealistic because I'm the senior policemen don't do much of that. They tend to be sort of back home at headquarters or in the incident room, but not getting out on the streets. And I thought, well, who does get out on the streets? And then I began to think, well, I do rather envy those writers of private eye stories, because the private eye could go everywhere. He was in on the action. He went, he was the one who knocked on doors and got into a chase and was in a fast car and there were sort of drive-by shootings and all that. And from there, it was a fairly straightforward move to think, well, why shouldn't a Diamond have a private eye coming in, making a thorough nuisance of himself, and getting in on one of Diamond's investigations and it becoming a kind of competition between them as to who got to the truth first. So that was the origin of Diamond and the Eye. And the Eye is a character called Johnny Getz, who is a fantasist. He's a Brit, really, and his sort of notions of America are rather phony, but picked up from clearly from a close reading of many of the classic private eye writers, and I'm able to quote from some of them through him in the course of the book, which I enjoyed doing. He's annoying at the beginning. You'd sort of tend to think, oh, I can't stand this guy. But as the book wears on, you begin to see there are a few other qualities, and maybe he has some merit. And you begin to think, well, I wonder, perhaps he will solve the mystery before Diamond does. And as I say, it's quite a competition. And I wrote a number of the chapters in the first person with Johnny speaking his views and saying, Diamond is a fat slob and things like that, thoroughly, having no respect whatsoever for this large detective, despite his high rank and so on. It that was a lot of fun for me. It's something I haven't done since the last detective, which you mentioned, that some of that was written in the first person, but since then, I've been writing everything from a sort of detached third person point of view. It was a nice change, stimulating for me. And I do like, I do need for my own sanity to try new things all the time.
Well, Johnny Getz and his motto, I mean, this is his business slogan. Johnny Getz is spelled G-E-T-Z, gets results. So, we already have him doing this kind of humor that, the private eye novel can be dark, but generally there's humor in not all, but in most of them, there's a, kind of a wisecracking or at least sardonic, if you want to call it that way, kind of a voice. And so you do really well with that. So who would hire Johnny Getz? Who is his client?
Oh, well, I remembered that one of Dashiell Hammett's short stories started with wonderful line. I think almost the best first line of any short story I can remember. It was a wandering daughter job. It was a wandering daughter job. And I thought, well, I can't use that, but I wonder about a wandering father. And so I began to think, well, a wandering father, so the father is missing. And I must find the, and the daughter will be the one who's concerned and who comes to Johnny Getz and is his client, and then gradually sort of gets involved with real murder and so on. So that was it. She was the daughter of a man called Hubbard. He was the he was the antique dealer in Bath.
Septimus Hubbard.
Sorry, I'm forgetting my own story. Septimus Hubbard, known as Seppi, who was a rather eccentric owner of an antique shop in Bath. Not a real one that I can put my finger on. It was a fictional antique shop, but a body is found in there when they break in looking for Seppi. A body's found in an Egyptian coffin, and a mystery is underway, of course, straight away.
I mean, realistically, you know, a private eye is not going to be investigating murder. They do, you know, it's missing person or fraud or, you know, that kind of thing that a private eye, because they're not actually policemen and can't arrest people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a missing person case, as you say, the wandering father. And I love the scene when they break into the shop. I mean, I've been in English antique shops, and you know they're marvels. Very crowded as a rule, often not well listed. You know, not great inventory control. And you know, so here we are with the and also, oftentimes not really regular hours. You know, it can be because they have to go off on buying trips or various things. Anyway, I love the body in the coffin, because, you know, obviously you think when there's a coffin, you're going to open it, there'll be a mummy or something. But
if
it's really a contemporary body? Which is what brings Diamond and Johnny Getz into an alliance, because Diamond has a murder, what appears to be a murder, and Johnny still has his missing person case. So off they go in very awkward harness together.
And the plot develops, obviously, and there's a rogue character who's shooting at people in the street, coming by on a little pedal a motorbike, a small Vespa type bike, and shooting off at people, and there's a few near misses, and in fact there's one hit, and it's quite serious, and someone ends up in hospital. So it's that's the beginning, and then it moves on towards a point where it becomes an art mystery, and involving what appears to be a piece of modern art, but isn't, and is later on revealed to be something quite different, and the centerpiece of the mystery towards the end.
So Peter, how do you put your stories together? I mean, do you just start with an idea, like it would be fun to, you know, bring in, I mean, for your 20th book, you want to do something special, right? You want to do something different, because it is a bit of a landmark. So we decide to bring in the American private eye, and I'm not entirely sure that Jenny has an overdose on American film. I mean, I have a theory, Peter, that more people know the Maltese Falcon from the movie and Humphrey Bogart than ever actually read the book.
Yeah.
I've done that, quizzed people a couple of times. We had years ago, I think here in Phoenix, there was some sort of a program in which we took part, and the Maltese Falcon was part of it. And I remember asking the audience for a show of hands about how many people had read the book versus watching the film. And the number of readers was significantly smaller than the number of movie fans. And, you know, that's true in a lot of classics, like The Big Sleep, once again, Bogart. You know, you wonder how many people read The Chandler and how many people remember the movie, that kind of thing. But however Johnny got it, whether it was from watching American movies or reading American Private Eyes, you know, he's got this kind of persona worked out, and he wants to.
I think he sees
the mission. So you're there, but then your story segues off into completely unexpected channels. Does that happen as you're writing it?
No. I think it through before I start to write the first chapter. I've got a pretty good synopsis worked out in my head, and quite a bit of it is written down. So I'm a terribly slow writer, Barbara. Very, very slow.
Can you be when
horrified when they hear how few, you know, the small number of words I'm producing each day? But if you do it every day, you've got a book towards the end of a year, and that's the way I've always worked. But when you work like that, you can't afford to waste words and go off on tangents and think later on, oh no, I've got a better idea, I'll do something else, or I didn't really like the way I wrote that. So it's got to be my way of working to plan it all pretty well before I begin. And I don't work in drafts. I write the whole thing down, and I can't leave chapter one until I'm satisfied that it's the chapter that will be presented to my agent and ultimately to the publisher. And then I can move on to chapter two, and gradually I work through the book. But I don't revise. I'll read it through and change the odd word, but I don't revise substantially at all.
Well, in order to work that way, you must have a fair amount of thinking time then, because, you know, if you're going to construct the basic story before you begin to write it, you know, you start out, as they say, you want to do something interesting. You want to bring in this American voice. Reasonably speaking, since he can't really plunge into a murder, you start out with a missing person case. Then we have what appears to be a murder. And then we wind up going off into a fraud case. And also, you know, is this the sort of thing where you take long walks and you know, come up with all of this before you, and then
yes,
you plot it out?
All those thoughts, the various, the possibilities have to be examined in the 5 or 6 weeks when I'm plotting. And I reject a lot of things, but ultimately I get a few good ideas that are strong enough to develop. And I begin to see how it will work and how much time I can allocate to the mystery and to Diamond and his family life a little bit, because he has this friend Paloma, and most people are very pleased to see that Paloma come into the story, and most of all Raffles, his cat, who people love, who's been going since I think the first or second book. Raffles would now be over 30, and I have aged him a bit, but you can kill off the detective's wife, you can kill off the detective even, but you never kill off the cat. So I've really got to keep going with Raffles. Somehow or other, he has to carry on as long as I continue writing the books. So I have him now, he has to be lifted onto a chair. He can't actually leap up as cats do. He's very elderly, but he's much loved, and he occasionally inspires Diamond to a new idea.
There's nothing wrong with having a senior detective and a senior pet. You know, as we move along, you just have to keep them, you know, still active, you know, still able to function, as you say, and be possible. But what fascinates me, because I think you're one of the cleverest plotters who write. I mean, I've always been so impressed with your plotting. Oftentimes, I'm not fooled all that often, but it's rare that I work out the solution to your books while I'm reading them. I mean, yeah, I've been reading crime fiction for 70 years now, so, you know, there aren't a lot of plots that I haven't seen. but when I pick up one of your books, I always know that that I'm going to be going off here with Peter, or in a few cases, you know, you wrote a wonderful standalone about a writer, I think, in a writing group, which I always always thought was amazingly clever. And you're always going to get me. And I think, how do you do that?
Oh, well, I do. The plot to me is terribly important. It has to work. It has to be a satisfactory plot with a few surprises along the way. It's got to be fair. I'm a sort of fair play writer. So I've got to plant the evidence during the course of the book. So the reader, when he gets to the end, will say, should have realized that. You know, he said this in three and all the rest. And that is, I don't know why, but I'm that kind of person who wants to tidy up every little piece and have it all explained satisfactorily by the end.
And you always follow Father Knox's rules, you know, no doppelgangers or evil.
Well,
Chinese.
No. Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I suppose I do.
You know, there's a sort of a fair play thing that goes back. The Detection Club, which is a different organization than the Crime Writers Association, has always had kind of a code that the writers who belong to it over the years. It's not a, you have to be selected, invited to join the Detection Club. And Martin Edwards is the current chairman, but thinking back over people like Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie and Harry Keating and Simon Brett, Julian Simmons, it's had a very distinguished roster of chairmen and members. I think Martin's years of practicing law have left him an especially clever administrator, because he seems to be able to deal with it all in just amazing ways. But Peter, you've also touched on something I think is so important and is obviously instinctual to you by now, but in every book, there's only so much landscape. There's only, so much territory, unless you're going to write War and Peace or something. So, it's important to allocate territory to the different parts of the story. There's the plot, there's the characters, there's the developing relationships, there's the cat, whatever. Mm-hmm. In order to give everybody enough space without either blowing up the book or making it so small it just doesn't work. Does that just kind of come to you instinctually, how you do that?
I think it probably does now that I'm well into the series. It's a matter of, as you say, of balance. It'd be wrong if you gave too many chapters to some particular episode and then try to introduce something else which is a subplot or whatever without integrating them in some way and making them work together towards the end. So I'm conscious of all those things, and when you started talking about the territory, the fact that Bath itself is almost a character in the stories, the buildings and the situations that happen and can only happen because it's that kind of city. Until this pandemic, I was leading a little walk around Bath on a Sunday morning, a Peter Diamond walk where we would visit the locations that I'd used in the books. I read a small extract from the book to illustrate the episode, and it was fun. And it started off in a small way, but it soon got rather well known, and I was getting far too many people signing up for it. We had to do it on a Sunday morning because there wasn't quite so much traffic, and I found I needed help from friends acting as escorts to make sure that everybody got across the road safely, and it was getting all a bit too much. So perhaps it's a good thing that I had to stop. But I enjoyed it, and I think they did too. One of Diamond's favourite places is in front of Bath Abbey. He sits there and looks up at the Abbey front, and there are carvings of angels climbing sort of up on one side and down in some cases on the other side, and he's sort of, when he feels uppish, he imagines himself as one of the angels who's, you know, getting on and solving the mystery. And then sometimes he feels he's one of the ones who's almost falling off the ladder, coming downwards. And so it's one of Diamond's favorite places. And I mentioned this on my walk, but unfortunately, it usually turns out that it's about 11 o'clock in the morning when the bells start up, when I'm about to give my talk about Diamond and the ladders, and we have to retreat, and I do it from a distance, but these bells are very annoying.
I can see. Do people have to quaff the mineral water? Do they actually pump a glass? And
well, they don't as part of my walk, but people can. For a time, it was considered to be contaminated with some horrible virus, and it was forbidden for quite a while. But I think these days you can taste it. It tastes pretty vile anyway.
Yes, it does. I remember it very well. I'm also not entirely sure that there wasn't a lead pipe involved, but anyway, yeah, I mean, as I said, it's called Bath in the Pump Room for a reason. When people had rather stodgy diets and so forth, you know, it was the mineral water was quite cathartic. And because it was warm, people could soak in it. So it was all very, very healthy. But Peter, I think you do yourself a disservice to say it's because you're well into this series. I think you've always had in all of your books that ability to space things out in a way that, you know, is very satisfying and gives a whole picture. You don't write super long books.
No,
it's very rare that I'm trying to think. This one, they're always three. I don't know what the word total is, but you know, probably somewhere around 90,000 words, something like that. But they usually run over 300 pages, 300 to 350, you know, and that's a very plenty. Nice size for a mystery.
Yeah, that's plenty.
Well, I've always remembered
when you're working writing about 200 words in a day. But I remember when Reginald Hill, was a very dear friend of mine, suddenly produced a book of about 500 pages. And I thought, really, we should report him to the union. This won't do, you know, this is really too much. If books are going to go that way, they had sung. I mean, Agatha Christie could get away with 60,000 words, quite thin books, many of hers. But and a lot of those Golden Age writers did. But by the time I began, It was starting to grow a bit. I mean, my early books were more like 70,000, perhaps. But now I do have to get to over 300 pages. Because of the paperback. People like to buy a paperback that is reasonably solid feeling. Do you agree with that? I mean, I think that a thin paperback doesn't necessarily appeal so much as a more solid one.
You know, it depends. I mean, you know, I think many people flinch away from too long a book, a real doorstop book, but then we're the Outlander bookstore where the average size is over 800 pages. So clearly there's a huge audience for that. I mean, Christie deliberately wrote her books small because the plots were so important to her. She wanted people to be able to finish one in one go, you know, I think she famously said something about, you know, between dinner and bedtime. She didn't want the reader to forget all the intricacies of the plot. And they used to end up padding because of the 32 pages in a signature. They used to end up padding some of the books with extra end papers in order to, you know, get to the right number of signature. But I think today people are not expected to, you know, to read it between dinner and bedtime. And therefore they've gotten somewhat longer. I just read a piece by Rhys Bowen for a book on an academic book on Christie, to which a few of us have been asked to contribute. And she pointed out that, you know, there's a lot more texture, a lot more characterization available today. Not available, desired today would be
fair. Exactly. Yes.
And so, you know, I don't think it's so much that the paperback looks thin as that the reader has an expectation of a certain reading experience.
More than just
too long, it can be daunting. And if it's too short, it probably doesn't look worthwhile. I'll tell you something I found interesting, then we're going to call Patrick up for questions, is that you know, we started as a mystery bookstore, but for the last 15 to 20 years, I've been unbranding us as a mystery store and you know, just fiction. And as a result of that, we sell a fair amount of romance, and we have a real romance specialist who's a very well-known reviewer and so forth. And I learned from that, that romance readers, if there is like a trilogy or a four book concept going that's known, they won't buy it and read it till it's completely written. In other words, you know, if this is book one in the romance trilogy, the readers won't buy it until book three is complete, because they don't want to be disappointed that it either doesn't finish, or, you know, or they want the whole reading experience at once.
Yes,
you know, that I find that interesting in terms of long form television, that some series, you know, they'll put up like an episode a week, but others, when they go up, it's the entire thing goes up. Like Bush, the Michael Connelly series, when it goes live, Amazon puts up all, however many it is, let's call it eight for lack of anything else, all eight episodes go up at once. So you could, in fact, sit down and binge your way through the entire season. Whereas others, you know, they put it up and they'll, you know, they give you one, and then the next one is the next week, and then the next week. And I find that sometimes people wait till the whole thing is up because they don't want to have to sit, you know, week after week wondering what's going to happen next. So it's oftentimes interesting to come to one like Line of Duty, which I'm sure, you know, you've been stirring. Rob and I didn't get to it. So, you know, we've been able to watch season one and season two. It's so dark, you have to like sit back because you just can't stand it. And it's so wrenching to watch it. But by this time, all six seasons are available. And so it's possible, if you're really gripped by one, you can say, okay, you know, let's watch two tonight. We don't have to wait till next week. And I think the same thing kind of goes on with readers.
I'm sure you're right.
I'm just extrapolating. Anyway, the really good news for you readers is that you've got 20 glorious books, and while you don't have to read them in any particular order, in fact, you really don't, because each one is complete, it is the most marvelous reading experience, and every single book is different. Every one. I mean, that is so remarkable. I just can't tell you how much I love these. Patrick, come and talk to us. See if we have any questions from readers, or if you want to chime in here.
All right. Actually, I have a question for you, Peter. I know that some of your the Sergeant Crib series was done for television, and that you had did you write some of the screenplays, as I understand it?
Yeah. Yes, what happened was that they used up the, I had eight books in the series when they started filming, and it went out on Sunday evenings here in prime time, and it was a popular series. So they thought they would like to run a second series, and they had asked me if I would look at the scripts of the first few that were done, adapted by other writers who were more experienced in writing for television, and one of them I didn't particularly like. I didn't think it was too well done, and I told them, and they said, well, would you like to have a go at doing this script? And so I did, and they used it, and so I sort of cut my teeth a little bit, and then they said, well, we'd like six more. So I said, well, how soon do you want them? And television uses up material very quickly. And basically it was about 8 or 9 months that we had to produce six more scripts. So I you don't turn down a chance like that. I came home and told my wife, Jax, and she'd always had a hand in the books, because she read far more than I did. She consumed mysteries at the rate of several a week. So I said, well, you know, is there any way you could help with this? And she said, I'm not a writer, and so on. But in the end, I persuaded her to divide the work. And so she produced three, and I produced three of the second series, which were written, rather than being adapted from books, they were written just for TV. And so they filled the 1 hour that it had to be in those days. more successfully, I think, than the originals, where they were trying to solve cover a fairly complicated plot. And so we did six altogether. I remember Jax had wrote a very good one about a wedding called Something Old, Something New, and that really was one of the best of the whole series of 13 that were eventually made.
And then I understand that some of the Birdie stories were adapted for the BBC radio, which seems...
Yes, that's right. All of them were, and they had great fun with them. They did the Cribs on radio as well, so it's I had a good run. You know, it was really good, and I've often thought that Bertie would work well on TV, but it hasn't happened. And various people have suggested that Diamond would.
Uh-oh, I think we have a pregnant pause here.
That's okay. He froze for just a minute, but it came back the last time.
Okay.
If it doesn't, then we've covered quite a bit.
Not a bad place to stop.
No, not at all.
We do have some questions. Not too
Do you have questions?
Not a whole lot. There are a few, though. Okay. Let's see here.
I don't know if Peter can hear us. If he does, he could exit and come back in.
Yeah, Peter, your screen is frozen, so we can't. You can try exiting. Okay.
Right. Here he goes. Let's see if he comes back. It's hard. It's hard to tell when it's you that
right.
has that problem. So give him a moment.
Have you seen some of the adaptations, Barbara?
I've seen some of the Wobble to Death. Yeah,
really?
I didn't. And you know, actually, radio. I mean, it's not any different than this current craze for podcasts and audiobooks. So you know, I think that radio adaptations. There he is, coming back.
Yeah,
you're back.
I'm sorry. I'm
no need to be sorry. You did really well.
Cut off in my prime.
Let me just ask you a few of these questions in case you get frozen again. Leslie says or asks, excuse me, wrong person. Jeff asks, what is Peter's favorite book of his own writing?
Wow, that is a tough one. It's one that's not so well known. It's called The Reaper, and it's about a wicked vicar who murders the bishop in the first chapter. It's not a whodunit. It's a will he get away with it type of story. But I had a lot of fun writing it, and it was closest to what I really wanted to do of all the books that I've written. So that's the answer to that one. The Reaper.
Let's what about see. The Circle? The Circle is the one, if I remember right,
oh, yeah.
about the writers group. And I think that's very clever also.
The group of writers, it was a lot of fun. And yes, it won me an award, and I was very grateful for that one. And it was based on a real group who met in the place that I featured in the story, in the crypt of St. Michael's Church in Bath. I went to give them a talk. They were a university extension group, and I went along and I was invited to talk about crime writing or something such, and I did. And I began to think after that, well, wouldn't it be fun if I you know, had a real murder involving these kinos who knew so much about crime fiction. And so that
now,
was
the let me say that Peter has written, I think, 38 books at this point, approximately, anyway. Is in the fortunate position that all of them are in print, which, you know, for many writers is not really not possible today for a variety of reasons. You've also had certainly more than one publisher over a long career, but your current publisher, Soho, has been wonderful about bringing all your books into print. And so if you're a person who is just discovering Peter rather than a longtime fan like me, you are so lucky. You've got all this wonderful reading material and you can actually buy it. Yay.
Starting with Bubble to Death, and it'll take you the rest of your life to get through.
Yeah, there's a handsome, was it a 50th anniversary edition? Maybe you mentioned it, Barbara, the little hardcover gift edition. That's really, really That's neat. Right. Yeah.
Very nice. But there's also, you know, they did a really nice, and I think a anthology, the Birdie Stories, they collected them in one volume. Mm-hmm. Which is really great, because I think they're best experienced if you just read them all together, you know, and sort of like one long Peter's version of War and Peace. but they're really fun. So I do think that it's marvelous that all of this is still available.
Yes, yes, I'm thrilled. I'm so happy and so delighted that they are all available.
Anything else?
A new art kind of look for the cover.
Yeah, yes, it is. It is.
Yeah, I like it.
Yes, I do. I do too. Yeah. Very striking. That
it's kind of Hitchcock even. I think that the silhouette of Peter Diamond reminds me a bit of silhouettes of Hitchcock, only Peter's slightly slimmer, but very Hitchcockian.
And I think the figure, you know, the figure in the background in red is must be Johnny Getz.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, no, it's definitely got a, you know, a sharp edge look, which sort of fits your characters in this particular book. Was there anything else, Patrick, in the way of a question?
There are a couple of them here. Let's see. Leslie asks, what are you working on now?
Another diamond is the answer, but I don't really like to talk very much about them because if I begin to describe what the stories or tell the stories, it takes away the magic for me a little bit. So apart from the fact that I can tell you it's diamond number 21, and it's about I kid myself, it's two-thirds through, and I'm enjoying doing it.
Well, that's all wonderful news. That's all we need to know.
There's also a question about your research. I'm sure you probably know the Victorian period anyway, pretty intimately from writing about it so much. But do you keep up with research or?
Yes, I've got a very good library here of books about Bath particularly, which I've collected over the years. So I consult them. I'm still old enough to enjoy researching the printed word more than just working on the internet, but the internet is wonderful. If I want any particular detail, I can pretty quickly get to it. I don't have to go to the newspaper museum to read old newspapers now. I belong to the British newspaper collection and can read digitized newspapers, which is again a help. And research is fun. Particularly when you chance on some little detail like the arrest of Jane Austen's aunt that nobody else seems to know about.
Let's see. Well, maybe a good final question. Who are some of your favorite authors, and do you keep up with crime fiction these days? Or
I wouldn't say that I keep up with contemporary crime fiction very well. This is always a stinger. So I'm not going to mention any of my friends or people that I know particularly well. But Patricia Highsmith, I think, was quite a genius at writing and plotting. And I do enjoy everything she's done. I like the Le Carré stories, the early ones particularly. I thought the older one, the later ones, got a little bit too diffuse for me. I think those are the two people that I would mention in particular. But of Americans, Donald E. Westlake, he wonderful writer, makes me laugh, and with the Stark books, he's you know, they're tough, hard-boiled thrillers. So everything he did was gold, pure gold for me. And he was a lovely man and a good friend.
He was a lovely man. You're absolutely right. It was a real privilege to know him. This is our 32nd year, Peter. And I look back and think, you know, all the way back to that banquet where we first met, which was 1990. What a wonderful, how lucky we have been to have known so many, you know, fabulous people, wonderful writers. But as a whole, crime writers are really wonderful people too. I mean, you know, obviously there's the odd lemon, but most crime writers are just great, yes. You know, collegial, yes. And interesting, and you know, really a pleasure to spend time with. So,
yeah. Yes, it's strange when you consider the material we're working with, but it is true. It's one of the friendliest groups that I know or can think of.
It absolutely is. But Peter, what a pleasure it's been to spend an hour with you. Thank you for your time. Readers, here we go, Diamond and the Eye. But honestly, if you don't know Peter's work, you can start with The Last Detective and work your way forward. Lucky you. And we will look forward to talking to Peter for Peter Diamond 21 or anything else that might come along. So thanks for your time, Peter, and enjoy your afternoon or your evening. In your case, you can go to bed. The rest of us, enjoy your afternoon. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you for this, Barbara. Really enjoyed it. Great to link up with you again.
It was a real pleasure, Peter. It always is. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.